Okay, now I'm nervous.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, absolutely. How you doing?
Great, doing great.
Oh, great. All right, hold on.
So my solution was to take the baby for a drive, and so he's sleeping in the car. So I was like, oh, so perfect.
Oh, well done.
Yeah, I'm just
recording in progress.
Awesome. Tell me when you're ready to start, and I'm going to... Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, what I'm going to do is we're just going to record. I'm going to lay the songs in when we're done. So I won't play them through now so we get more interview time. Is that cool?
Cool.
All right. Beautiful. All right, man.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Let's get going.
Okay.
I just do like a little stupid ditty thing here. Quick. Hold on. I'm nervous playing for you. Hey, this is John. This is home from here. This is a historic home from here because we're in brand new studios, but normally brand new studios would be the big news for the show because you don't know, Layla, but we went from like a little tiny room to like three studios and it's crazy. But the big news, and that's why I'll talk about the other news next show, is Layla Statz is with me. And I'm fucking nervous, but she's being very kind. Hey, Layla.
Hey, Sego, what's going on? I guess so. Does that mean we can swear on the show? I
was like, oh, totally. No. You can totally swear. You can say
right, we are off the cuff and raw here today.
Now you're outside.
I am. I'm on Six Nations here on the territory, which is awesome.
And you're in Ontario?
Yeah, so from Six Nations of the Grand River, so it's in Southern Ontario.
Okay.
The Great Peaks.
Okay. I know where I want to start. I know your music well, so I'm going to save that for the end. And you pick. You want to start with the documentary or your activism?
Oh, goodness. Okay, well, first I'll introduce myself.
Please.
Sego, Skenevolga. That's young gats. Ah, no, I don't like it. That Roden, can you out the hugger? You are going Jordan or Swago need a wagino. So I just said hello. My name is Layla Statz. I'm Mohawk Turtle Clan from the Six Nations of the Grand River. And even introducing myself, like using my native language, can you out the hugger? Mohawk is something that has been part of my journey. I wasn't taught my language, I wasn't taught my culture, my teachings. Wasn't passed down to me from, you know, my grandma, like it was supposed to. It was something that I had to reclaim on my own. It was something that I had to seek out. It's been a journey for the last, I guess, maybe 4 years of really reclaiming my Mohawk identity, what was taken from me long before I was born. You know, my grandfather, who was a very a prominent inspiration for the film, the documentary Boil Alert. He was a generational survivor of the Mohawk Institute, the longest running residential school in Canada. And you know, it was interesting because he was such a strong man, so wise, and taught me so many things. But when it came to being Mohawk, he had a fear, and he carried this fear. And you know, he taught us, you know, to hide it, like it was something bad, like it was something that we would be discriminated for. And so that was kind of how I was raised. But I always knew inside of me that, you know, it was calling, you know, this connection that I had was calling me. So yeah, I've been on this journey. It's taken me down a wild path of my relationship with water. And it's not just something that, you know, I'm grateful for. It's not just something I give thanks for, but it's something, it's like someone that knows me. And that personal relationship that I have with water has been kind of a guiding force for the films, for the activism, and for the music. So it all kind of stems there.
Do you look at what your grandfather did as protecting you or something he gave you that you had to overcome?
Both. It was a means. He thought he was protecting me.
Right.
You know, he thought he was giving me a better life. He thought that it was going to serve me well. And it was just what he knew. It was what he was taught by his mother. You know, it was his mother actually went to the school. So she, you know, when she spoke her language, she was beat. So that language was lost in our family. We call it kind of the coat of shame. And it's like this coat of shame that a lot of Indigenous people have because of those schools that really implemented that on our identity. So, but it was something that I had to overcome in many ways. You know, I grew up in town. So I grew up in the town just outside of the reserve. So it was like this feeling of not really knowing where I belonged.
Right.
You know, I didn't fit in on the res. I didn't know my language. I didn't go to Longhouse. I didn't know any of the things that were associated with, you know, being Mohawk. But I also didn't really fit in town. You know, I was different. I looked different. I was, you know, clearly my last, you know, I'm Native. So there was a lot of searching that I had to go through in my growing up days.
To learn the language, it's not a written language? Or is it?
It is now. Yes. For, you know, for many, many years, it was orally spoken only. But it is translated. So there's a lot of resources out there for language revitalization. We just had, like, I think it was National Indigenous Languages Day that just passed. So there's a lot of hope for keeping these languages alive. But it's also not, it's like you have to deprogram your entire brain. Just like, you know, all of us are on like this decolonizing our mind. It's the same thing with the languages, because the language was so specific on how, you know, it took on a different essence of how everything was related to each other. You didn't speak about, you know, you didn't say anything without first acknowledging like who it was associated with, who it was related to. It's been so, so eye-opening for me to start learning the language and reprogramming my brain that way.
How good are you at it? Are you fluent in it?
No. I've got like cue cards around the house to help me with, you know, passing important phrases and things like that to my kids so that they're common in our house. But yeah, I'm not fluent, not yet.
And how long have you been doing it? Just a couple years, right?
Yeah, just like 3 years. Off and on. But it's hard because if you're not in a place where people are speaking all the time.
Right. You know, that was my next question. Where do you get to practice? Almost never, right?
Yeah, it's hard. I've done some virtual classes, but I really like the in-person ones where, like, there's just something that happens in this classroom when we all speak the language together.
And yeah.
It's just like, it's almost like you can feel like our ancestors applauding and they're like, yes, they're speaking the language.
That's so awesome.
Which is pretty cool.
That's really, do you, now you have a boyfriend?
Yeah, I do.
Do you make him, is he learning it?
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing about our relationship is that he grew up on the res. His mom is like a fluent language speaker. He went to immersion schools. He went to Longhouse. You know, he's sort of got all the things that I didn't get. So he's been a great sort of support system to kind of guide me back.
So I can't, like, so you don't know my story. I'm an orphan, right? And I just recently, I'm a 60-year-old man. I'm an orphan. And I just recently, like within the last 3 months, met my first blood relatives that I ever knew that I didn't make. I mean, I made a daughter, so that's a blood relative. But, and I can't imagine a passion like yours where you would go to the extent of learning a language to reclaim an identity. I imagine it would be partially just kind of a fuck you to the history of having it taken away from you. Like, is that part of it?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of moments like that where it's just like we did a concert on the front steps of the residential school. So we did a musical concert.
That's beautiful.
We were, you know, like singing the language, doing our songs and like our own creative songs of the new generation mixed with the old. it was just so powerful, and it was just like a big like, we're still here.
Good.
And
we
are owning the space, and we are taking it back. And it was like a really cool evening concert event.
Well, okay. I've done my homework on you before I even reached out to you. I did my homework on you because I'm like a gigantic admirer, and you got arrested for protesting, and the cop winked at you.
Yeah, that's
that's creepy as F.
Yeah, and I try not to think about that moment too much, but when I do,
sorry,
I just no, it's okay. I don't actually realize sometimes how kind of gross it was, because I just kind of like try to put it back. But
right.
I remember, you know, like it's this huge traumatizing event. You just got arrested. This wall of cops and guns and dogs just, you know, came at you, and you're shaking, and you're just scared, and you don't know what's going to happen. And then you get put in the back of this cruiser in handcuffs, and you know, I just look up the window, and he like smiles and winks at me like I'm cute or something. And I was just like, really?
That's insane.
I turned to the land defender that's beside me. I'm like, he just winked at me.
That's
and it was like this feeling of like, there's nothing I can do.
Right.
It's not illegal. He didn't break any law. You know, it was just this feeling of knowing that he would thought he was in a position he could do that.
Right.
And it was very sickening, but I mean, of all the things that you know, it was the entire experience. You know, even just standing there and seeing this wall of, you know, what I call like Canadian law coming
yeah.
towards me, you know, and I'm like, this is reconciliation. This is you know, looking down the barrel of a gun.
Yep.
Is
literally
this idea. Of, you know, solving these issues and how is this their solution? How is this their go-to? Like, let's just send in the army and arrest them all.
Right.
You know, it doesn't sound like reconciliation to me. So it was, the entire experience was very, very eye-opening, and it happens to be in the film. So, you know, everybody knows. It's kind of like, that was one of the things with the documentary, is it's very personal.
Right.
You know, I get very, very deep into the healing journey, which I didn't expect. You know, I thought it was just going to be me walking around with a microphone, like telling these stories of people struggling with boil water advisories.
Right.
And then, you know, as every place, every kitchen I sat at, you know, every story I heard, I could feel like this unpacking in me. It was like this healing was going on at the same time, and it turned into, you know, the kind of the secondary storyline of the documentary, and I think what makes it very unique.
Tell people what you were protesting, please.
Yeah, so we were in Wet'suwet'en, so that location is in BC, and they're Wendziqua. They call it the Wendziqua, but it is this beautiful, pristine glacier-fed river that all of the salmon come to spawn to, that all of the neighboring tribes rely on, and they want to, well, they are drilling a pipeline, and the pipeline is going to go under the river. So the Wet'suwet'en tribe have said no. They've made it very clear that there will be no pipelines passing through their territory, but the Canadian government and the corporations have ignored that. And so we were protesting the pipeline and trying to stop it. And they are still fighting.
Okay. So is there something our listeners could do to support that effort?
Well, they actually just released their own documentary that they've been filming for the last 3 years on the territory. It's called Yinta. And I mean, you can definitely support any chance that you have to, you know, amplify these messages, to put their stories out there. It makes a difference. I know people think like, does an Instagram share actually matter? But why it matters is because suddenly it's not just, you know, an Indigenous voice that's out here talking about land back, that's talking about, you know, boil water advisories, that's talking about water is life. It's suddenly all of us. It's like your kindergarten, your kid's kindergarten teacher. It's your crossing guard. It's the bus driver. It's your neighbor. And it becomes like this collaborative voice that is just so much more powerful. So yeah, begin to access on Instagram, and yeah, give them a follow and support what they're doing.
And do they need money? Does money help?
Oh yeah. So, I mean, legal fees, that's probably the one issue that holds back, land claims, land defenders, legal fees. We have, it's been crazy. The amount of legal fees, hundreds of thousands of dollars to defend ourselves as being criminalized by the courts. And, you know, most people don't have the ability to do that.
Sure.
So, you know, like fundraising with the Land Back Lane and with Wet'suwet'en, like they have set up legal funds that help the land defenders. So I haven't had to pay that, which has been amazing. And so they do have support. And that's been mostly just from people donating.
Okay. And I'll figure out, I'll post a link when we post the show on where to.
Yeah, I'll send them over to you.
Okay, so
you
perfect, perfect. Mm-hmm. What did how does this affect you personally, like emotionally? Because I imagine most anger passes, but I imagine this would be an anger that I almost that wouldn't pass, and that would get me. Am I wrong?
No, I mean, it's like at first it was a fear. You know, I came back and I was like, I was afraid. I was afraid to do interviews like this. I was afraid to be on TV. I was afraid to, you know, do an Instagram post that was, you know, truly speaking about what I've been through. And I was at a rally like 3 days after I got back. And I just like, as soon as I saw cops, as soon as I saw those cherries, I was just like paralyzed in my car.
Yeah.
I couldn't get out. And I was, and all these, you know, there was like CHCH, CTV, all these news channels wanted to interview me about what I had been through. And I was like, no, I can't. Like, they're going to see it. They're watching me. They're tracking me, all these things. And then it was like this clicking moment in my brain that was like, this is what they wanted. This is why they did that. Mm-hmm. This is why there was such use of force. This is why, you know, there was intimidation tactics. This is why it happened that way. So I would be quiet so that I would sit paralyzed in my car and not speak out. And I was like, no way, I'm not letting them win. You know, whatever fear I got to get through, I'm going to get through. And, you know, since then, any chance I have to, you know, be on stage or speak at an event or, you know, do an interview or whatever it is, it's like, you know, I'm just going to keep using my voice. I'm going to keep telling the story. I'm going to keep putting it out there. And I'm, you know, no one is going to push me into being afraid to tell my truth. So, that fear has been converted.
one of the best things I think you're doing, aside from the cause, is showing your children how to be forward facing, and you know, it's hard enough to be forward facing anywhere. To be forward facing when there's real potential, like you got handcuffs, when there's real consequence. I think showing I just want to applaud you for that, because I think showing your children that is I think that's something that will ripple generations.
Yeah, I mean, they were my first thought.
Sure.
Standing on that, I was like, you know, what are my kids going to think when they see mom on the news arrested? You know, how am I going to explain this to them?
They're going to think mom is badass, is what they're going to think.
Well, you know, we've been programmed to feel like, you know, the bad guys get arrested. So is mom a bad guy?
Right.
And, you know, you get called these words like terrorist, and you're worried. I was definitely worried. I was like, well, what about their teachers? Like, what are their teachers going to think when I pick them up from school? They're like, oh, that's that mom.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so all of those things were factors in that moment. But in that moment, I was like, I was looking at Canadian law coming at me with guns. And I just asked myself, I was like, whose laws do I live by? And whose laws am I willing to die for? And it is not the law that is coming at me with guns. It is the law that I feel from the earth in my boots. It is the law that I felt when I drank from that river. It's the law of, you know, this land and my connection and my relationship to it. And that's what I want my kids to know, you know? And so it was interesting because in my court case, my charges were amplified to criminal charges. And in my disclosure, it said, because I was using my social platform, I was using my influence to encourage people to break the law.
Mm.
And in my mind, you know, I'm not encouraging my kids or anyone to break the law. I'm encouraging them to question it. Right. I'm encouraging them to stand up and actually use their own, you know, their own gauge of right and wrong. And when they see something wrong, even if it's Canadian law, if it is wrong, you speak out. You know, you recognize, you identify, and you use your voice. And, you know, I will never condemn my children for speaking out about something they believe is wrong, even if it breaks the law.
There is this amazing moment. I'm positive this moment made the documentary, but there's this amazing moment where you're on it's a bridge, and you're getting arrested, and you're right. There's 9 of you, right? And
yeah.
across from 9 from you is a militia, and there's 9 of you. You know, 2 of the 9 appear to be over 60, and
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's so much overkill, and you're coming towards each other, and you guys circle around the elders, and I cried when I saw that. Because I thought, I'm crying now, because I thought how beautiful a heritage where that's the move you make. Just cover the elders. And can you tell me what that was?
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty clear that we weren't going to hold any line. Or
right.
We weren't going to, you know, like we were clearly, outnumbered.
Yeah. Yeah.
They had the automatic rifles, you know.
Right. So, they had the automatic rifles, and you had peace. That's so.
Yeah, we had peace and drums and rattles.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that was just our move. We had Auntie Janet out there, and she's an elder. She's, you know, the grandmother figure to so many people out there, and she's also not afraid of cops. And so, you know, she was right up there.
Love
with
that.
The cops. And so
you can see that in her face, by the way. You guys caught that. You could see her face. She was there. There was sadness that this was occurring, but there was zero fear.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And she has a very special part in my documentary. We did a special interview with her about that day. And yeah, it was just like, we didn't even say, you know, circle around Auntie Janet. It just was like a natural instinct for all of us to protect her.
Yeah.
And then I would say, like, my one, looking back at that day, it was like the one thing that I wish I could change was we started to sing the Mohawk water song.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting because we were all from different nations, but somehow we all knew the words. And so we were all singing like, Yunganalungwa onega. And then when the song was over, was the exact moment that, you know, they attacked and they started arresting us and started going after my brother first, because obviously he's the biggest.
Right.
And yeah, so I was just like, I wish that I had just kept singing the song and turned it into like the song that never ended.
Right.
And sang it for days. But yeah, so as soon as we stopped singing.
What was that like seeing your brother? Because you said it's like his legs were at a weird angle and they were.
Yeah. Well, it was crazy because I had literally braided his hair that morning. And I did those braids. And then I saw the cop grab him by his braids and shove his face into the ground. And I was like, those braids are sacred.
Yeah.
And, you know, like there was just like, I don't know, like 10 cops on top of him. They had his legs pulled back so that he was kind of like in a backwards position. And it was just like.
And he's unarmed.
Oh, yeah. We were all unarmed.
Yeah.
We had no weapons. He's like, I can't breathe. I can't breathe. And there's this, the word for big sister is Ukjio. So as an Ukjio, there's like this instinctual protect my little brother.
Of course.
And I just wanted to attack. Like, I just wanted to like jump on them and start like biting their ears.
Yeah, man.
but I had a conversation with one of the elders, Frida Hewson, who was also arrested. And her story is in the documentary, but she said, you know what? They're going to try and make you, you know, react in violence. They're going to try and make you angry. She said, just keep the peace. And so I remembered, I was like, this is how we win. This is who we are. This is how we, you know, deal with conflict, is through peace, love, you know, song, connection. So I just, I just bit my tongue, I guess, and God stood back bless. And, you know, I was like, okay, just remember who you are. Remember why you're here, and don't let them pull that anger and rage from you.
Right.
And don't let them win in that way.
One of the things that your culture does right that my culture does way wrong is you know how to squeeze the juice out of elders like crazy. And we do the exact opposite. Can you just give me 1 minute on how much you value experience and age? And
yeah, for sure. I mean, that is how we received our knowledge. That is, you know, there was no books, there was no online courses, there was no TV, there was no YouTube where you could just look up something. The way that you received your knowledge and everything that was important was through your elders, was through that oral transfer of knowledge. So, you know, it's so vital for our youth to have that connection, which is something that I really saw the impacts of in places like Grassy Narrows, in places in the Navajo Nation, where their elders are literally dying because of poison, because of radiation, because of mercury poisoning, all of these things. Like the life expectancy in Grassy Narrows is like 55 years old.
What?
Because of mercury poisoning, because their entire community has been poisoned by mercury from a paper mill plant. And
where is this?
In Grassy Narrows.
Okay.
It's like Northern Ontario, Northern Ontario. One of 55. These
55.
And yeah, nobody knows about it. And that's
they one do of the now. Crazy things.
It's like, it's why I really hope Boil Alert, I'm really hopeful that it will have an impact, a real true impact, because the stories in this documentary, like once you hear them, you can't unhear them. You can't unknow this stuff. You can't pretend like Grassy Narrows doesn't exist.
Right.
And their community is in a state of emergency, not because of their poisonous water, but because of their youth suicide. So what we're seeing is because the elders, there's not a lot of elders left. And, you know, that disconnection of, you know, the youth having that support system, you can really see the impacts. Yeah, it was when I start talking about this stuff, it kind of gets to me, because you know there's people in my film, you know, that never got to see it because of, you know, taking their life because of drugs and alcohol. I think there's like three people in the film that are no longer with us, and it's just like that's a reality.
And the film isn't old.
No, it just came out in September. Yeah. We premiered at TIFF. And it was...
And you won Best Documentary.
Yeah, it was crazy. We, you know, it's kind of like when I think of documentary, a lot of times I think of like talking heads, information, factual stuff. This is not your normal documentary. Every time we've done a screening, you know, it's just been a whole theater full of crying people. And as much as, you know, I'm like, I'm sorry I made you upset. I'm sorry I made you cry. But
don't be. No, you. That's good.
This is the time when we need to get uncomfortable. And some of the things in this film are uncomfortable. But I think that that's what sets it apart, is because not only are we giving you information that you've never known before and you never heard, but we're making you feel it in your heart.
Right.
And that's how you create change.
Where do I see the film?
So Boil Alert is just doing its festival tour right now.
Okay.
But we are doing some private bookings. So you can check that out. You can always just DM me. I'm like a real person that answers my own Instagram and my own Facebook.
I can attest to that.
Yes. So, just send me a message. I get lots of messages from teachers and students. And then we can talk about the film. I also created my own, and this was like 3 years ago. This was what got me, I think what got me the part in Boil Alert was my own personal documentary called Blood and Water.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was like a 20-minute film that I made by myself, kind of sharing my beginnings of my journey. I call it the prequel. But yeah, that one I have access to, so you can send me a message and I can send you that one.
Okay, and if you like, I'll post a link to it when we post the show because
cool.
All right, beautiful. You deal with such important stuff every day. And at the same time are so grounded. How do you balance that? Like you make time to go fill a jar and drink water while you're making movies about suicide and radiation. Is that a job or does that come natural to you? And if so, how? Because I can't do it.
I don't want to just talk about this stuff. You know, it's not just stuff I talk about. It's stuff that I live every day. So, you know, when I drive over the river, I say, Sego River, Sego Oneganos. And I speak it out loud and my kids hear me and they say hi to the river. And every place I'm at, you know, I spend that moment and just introduce myself, you know, Sego to the water here. Thank you. And so it's like, it hears me. I know this. And that's what this is all for.
Mm.
You know, that connection, that's the medicine that, you know, that I want people to feel. And I want my kids and my grandkids and my great grandkids to feel. So that's the fuel for the work. And if you're, you know, if the work can be, it can be hard, you know, to keep, I think someone sent me a message and they're like, how do you just keep, you know, telling these stories over and over again. And, you know, it's like, I feel like it is my responsibility. You know, I feel like I have a responsibility to make sure these stories are heard. And I know that, you know, when I stand in front at a keynote speech, when I stand in front of a high school, I know that people receive it. You know, they take it with them in a way that is unique. And
right.
So recognizing, you know, that that's a gift for me, you know, being able to penetrate people's hearts and make them feel stuff. So you knowing that's my gift, you know, I'm like, well, it's your job, you know, to tell these stories and make sure people actually take them with them. And that kind of also led me down to the music path, because during this journey, you know, I was like, dealing with so much stuff, and music became this channel where, you know, where I could just let it out. I could just like purge it all and put it into a song. And, you know, it was really healing. So, you know, a lot of the songs on my album I'm working on were written, you know, during the film process.
Okay. Now you're a drummer. Do you play other instruments?
No. I you know, dabble in like keys, but I can play three chords on guitar. But I've written songs with those three chords, so.
Oh, that's all you need is, oh, well, you know, that all you need is three chords.
Exactly.
Do you, what's the name of the album? Have you named it yet?
No.
Okay.
No. We've only released one song so far, which is White Pine.
Right.
And but it's like cool. It's like, oh my god, I'm on Spotify. That's me.
You're gonna be again because we're gonna debut the other one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm so awesome. I didn't say this when we were talking. Thank you for the opportunity to do that. That is so cool. I really appreciate that, and I will do my best to drive as many ears as I can to it because it's a really cool song. And I'm putting it in post, so we won't hear it here. But when you hear the show, it'll be in there. And it's
right on.
Yeah, no, you're. When did you start writing music?
Shoot. I've written music for a long time, but I think I never really had the confidence to, you know, play for someone or share it with anyone. I've been singing backups for my brother Logan Stats for, I don't know, years, decades, it feels like. So it was just like this moment felt right for me to step out from, you know, backup vocals and harmonies. And, you know, I was like, you know what? I have songs inside of me.
Yeah.
I got to put these out, you know, like I got to share them with the world. So yeah, it was just waiting for the right moment. You know, I've always been a songwriter. I've always been a singer, but it was just waiting.
It
for
takes
the moment
time.
When...
Yeah. Yeah. No, I get it. I wasted 30 years in a corporate career until I started to put my stuff out there. So I get it. You and Logan have a really cool relationship. Is it what it looks like?
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's ride or die.
there you go. Okay.
You know, I've picked him up off the floor. He's picked me up off the floor. It's like that one person that you know has your back, loves you no matter what. And yeah, we definitely are each other's support system. We have babies too. So we both have babies that are like a month apart,
right?
Which is pretty cool to be impacting that next generation.
Yeah.
And,
man.
And like doing that together, we take them on tour. They've been to many cool concerts and festivals and yeah. So, it is what it seems.
That's fantastic. God bless. You have a unique combination that could get a little bit off the charts. You're politically active and ridiculously articulate at it. You're a really good musician. You have nobility out your ears. At some point, fame is going to be something that you have to manage if it isn't already. And I suspect that you're doing it right now, but if you're not, you're going to be. Do you have a limit to this? There's going to be a point where you can't just put on boots and go down to the river and drink a jar without being photographed by people that you don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess I don't really know what that looks like. I'm just me, you know? And so I think the only limit that I put on it is the limit that I have for myself. And I know that, you know, I'm only putting good out.
Right.
So that's kind of doing it with a good mind, doing it for the right reasons. So not to be famous, not to make money, you know, like all of like making sure that I stay grounded in all of the reasons why I'm doing this. I think that's what's going to keep me on the path.
All right. So I'm going to open the show with White Pines. I'm going to close the show with the other song. What's the title of the other song? What do you want me to use?
Creeping.
Perfect.
So the song that you guys are going to debut here that hasn't been heard by anyone in
that's
the world.
So crazy. Creeping. Thank you so much.
And it was written with another indigenous blues artist named Brock Stonefish, who is crushing it, killing it. And it has kind of a different vibe. So I'm excited for you guys to hear.
We got a really cool vibe. And you're parenting, so I'm going to – but can I beg you to come back like in a couple weeks and do a follow-up show once people have heard the songs and you've gotten some feedback and stuff?
Heck yeah, we're going out to the Junos in Halifax. My brother's nominated for a Juno this year.
There you
so
go.
So let's connect after that.
Okay, you got it. Thank you so much for doing this. I'm probably your biggest fan. Who's not a stalker. I bet you have stalkers, but absent stalking, I'm probably your biggest fan. I love the work you do. I love the energy you have. I love how you parent. I love how you dress. I'm fanboying out, man. You're the best. And thank you for doing this.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, John.
Oh, no problem at all. Go be a mom. Talk to you later.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. All right. All right, that worked out. Hi, how you doing?
I finally get to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Oh, no, please. I'm so stoked.
I told him that you want to ask me.
Hi, John. How are you?
Nice to meet you. John.
Nice to meet you.
Here's your shirt.
Oh, thank you very much.
I said to Mike Weberly, really? Thank you.